This is Unanimous Dissent, broadcasting from the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. We are the District Sentinel. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight. Coming up, our preview of election issues this week takes us to the state of Wisconsin. Ruth Conniff, the editor of the Madison-based Progressive magazine, talks to us about the battle between incumbent Ron Johnson and former Senator Russ Feingold.
And we're not going to make a single cheese joke during the entire interview.
Yeah, it's going to be hard, but I think we can pull it off.
I think so, too. Then the Paris Climate Agreement takes effect today. Humanity is saved. Well, not quite. We're still doomed, and we'll explain why in our sludge report later.
Also, folks, a historic moment today. We're making some damn history on the show because today is the last edition of the garbage can before the 2016 presidential election. And like every Friday, we'll be casting our votes to see who goes in the can this week. Stick around until the end of the show. As always, you won't want to miss it.
I don't want to miss it, and technically I can't miss it. I have to be here for it.
Same.
And I'm happy about that, to be honest.
Yeah. True.
But first, before we get to all that, let's eat our vegetables as we have to do the rest of the show first before we get to the garbage can. A word on the FBI, an agency that's in complete meltdown mode, in rapid succession over the last week, kicking off with FBI Director Comey's notification to Congress of a new development that could be related to the closed Clinton email investigation. Since then, over the last week, we've seen a rapid succession of unauthorized leaks coming from the agency. Leaks directed at harming the FBI director's reputation, leaks directed at embarrassing the Trump campaign, leaks directed at embarrassing the Clinton campaign. We've seen leaks that target the Democratic nominee for Senate in Florida, Patrick Murphy, about an investigation into him. We've learned that the FBI may be investigating Trump and his advisors for ties to Russia. The Department of Justice and FBI agents have been at each other's throats over decisions to investigate the Clinton Foundation. All of this, all of these leaks, all of this sniping back and forth coming out of this agency days before the election, all of it's pretty unnerving. It's hard to know what to believe, what's motivating a lot of these leaks.
It's hard enough to know what to believe from the Justice Department and the FBI.
Right.
Under normal circumstances.
Yes. So this is all pretty unnerving. All of it making a pretty good case for why the FBI should be purged, frankly. At least that's my take on it. Purge the FBI. Sam, you agree? Purge the FBI?
Purge it.
Purge it.
Purge it.
Now that we're in complete agreement on this topic, let's turn now to some economic news for the 99%.
Got to bring you some news about our boys at Wells Fargo.
Oh, yeah.
The SEC is finally joining in the party.
Welcome. We've been in this party for a while over
here.
Yeah.
We're in the
dunk on stump party.
Yeah. The mega bank announced on Thursday in disclosure filings that the Securities and Exchange Commission was among the many agencies probing its sales practices in the wake of the 2 million account falsification scandal. The news came about half a day after the Wall Street Journal first reported the development on Wednesday night in a story noting that the SEC had asked Wells for documents and that the investigation is still in, quote, an early stage.
It'll progress, I'm hoping, at least. That's some wood knocking.
Left of center legislators have been strongly pushing for law enforcement officials to look into alleged fraud by Wells Fargo executives after it was announced in September that the bank reached $185 million in settlements over the falsifications with two federal agencies and Los Angeles prosecutors. Elizabeth Warren, Bob Menendez, and Jeff Merkley, all Democrats on the Senate Banking Committee, asked the SEC in late September to look into Wells Fargo's compliance with laws on securities fraud, whistleblower protections, and accounting controls. Controls, by the way, that were signed into law by George W. Bush in the wake of the Enron accounting scandal.
The good old days of that scandal.
Those laws are known as Sarbanes-Oxley after the two legislators that drafted it. Although the SEC investigation was just announced this week in early November, the Justice Department announced in mid-September it would be looking into the matter of Wells executives allegedly being aware there were problems with its sales targeting while doing nothing about it. The SEC has also come under unusual pressure of its own in recent weeks, more broad pressure, after Senator Warren asked President Obama to fire SEC Chair Mary Jo White, saying that White has a poor record of enforcing securities laws.
She made a pretty good case for that, too.
I would say so. And as we've noted on this show, it's kind of bizarre seeing a prominent lawmaker call for a president from her own party to fire a key regulator this close to an election. But I got to say, it's refreshing and perhaps a warning from Warren to Hillary Clinton that the progressive firebrand won't rubber stamp Wall Street friendly nominees.
Or maybe she's just doing Putin's bidding as well.
Who isn't? I know.
Yeah.
I know for a fact we are, right?
Yeah.
Wells Fargo executives have argued that they have held people accountable for the account falsifications, noting they fired 5,300 employees believed to have engaged in the wrongdoing. But many lawmakers are arguing the bank should have disclosed to investors the problems it was having with its workforce, which it has admitted to occurring between 2011 and 2015. Wells Fargo stock was priced at around $50 per share before news of the account falsification settlement broke. The company's stock has since lost about 10 cents on the dollar in the 2 months since. Bank executives also seem to have tacitly acknowledged problems with their sales targets, scrapping cross-selling goals for its retail employees. That's a pretty big admission that maybe, you know, their eye was not on the ball. And of course, the longtime CEO at the time of the scandal, John Stumpf.
Stumpf
has resigned after trying to do damage control in congressional testimony before the House and the Senate that these guys right here sitting behind the microphones have definitely reported on.
Yeah, I think the thing that's going to nail Wells Fargo is this whole not disclosing to investors. The fact that their company, that Wells Fargo, is making money hand over fist as a result of all these scams.
Yeah. I would say so. And there appears to be even more evidence to bolster the case that they were just totally... You know, they totally knew about this, but they didn't care because of, you know, cost of doing business, short-term profits, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
So this was revealed Thursday in a letter from Senators Warren, Menendez, and Senator Ron Wyden to Wells Fargo's new CEO, Timothy Sloan. Got a clever thing about Sloan, you know. Are we going to own Sloan?
Are they going to own Sloan?
I think they are going to own Sloan.
Let's hear it.
Maybe not Sloan personally, but because, you know, he took over afterwards. But anyways, the senators asked questions to Sloan about misrepresentations in Wells Fargo's filings with FINRA, the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority. Now reading from the press release, which was again sent out Thursday. With five of its subsidiaries regulated by FINRA, Wells Fargo is required to file a form U-5 when an employee is terminated or otherwise leaves the firm. The senators noted that new information obtained from FINRA revealed that from 2011 to 2015, Wells Fargo filed over 200 U-5 reports with FINRA for employees who were fired for actions related to the unauthorized accounts scandal. Reading now from the three senators' letter, if this is the case, then it would appear that Wells Fargo concealed key information from regulators that may have revealed the bank's misdeeds long before the September 2016 settlement. And they also noted that these FINRA reports, quote, confirm that Wells Fargo had ample information about the scope of fraudulent sales practices occurring at the bank long before the CFPB settlement. And they raise additional questions about Wells Fargo's response to the illegal activity. So, man, some bank executives might finally get nailed.
I hope so. This adds to, we've had a CFPB investigation into this that fined Wells Fargo, what, like $100 million or something?
$100 million, yeah, on top of more from the OCC and Los Angeles prosecutors.
So now we've got the SEC looking into the matter. We also have the Department of Labor looking in, or at least has been called to look into the issue of how the company treated employees who are part of this cross-selling program.
Yeah, with the forced arbitration, I believe.
Yeah.
But yeah, DOJ was on it right away. Within a week of the scandal breaking, they were out there saying, yeah, of course we'll look into this.
Wasn't there a commercial we saw the other day of like a dig at Wells Fargo from another bank that was on a...
Oh, it was Discover. I think Discover Card put out an ad that was something like, oh, we aren't going to pressure you with like sales targets. And they didn't mention the bank by name. But Wells Fargo separately, we should notice, has put out a number of ads, including, by the way, I listen to World Series on the radio, Game 7 on the radio. There were Wells Fargo ads during Game 7 on 980 AM here in Washington, D.C., basically being like, we want to make things right to you.
I have a feeling they're going to be spending a lot of money on ads to try and get customers back.
Yeah, and you're seeing a lot of those on cable news, too. They just so want to make things right. Poor babies.
Poor babies. Poor Stumpf. Pray for Stumpf, everybody. I guess he's got nothing to do with it. He's got his money and he's cut. Although yeah. They're trying to claw back some of that too.
Pray for Stumpf to get dumped. He's agreed to some of the clawbacks, but be nice to see him in a jumpsuit.
Yeah, I wouldn't mind seeing that. All right, let's turn now to some news that's important for the planet.
Oil spill stretching for miles.
A torrent of methane gas is spewing into the air.
The Sludge Report.
All right, I've got some good news, and I got some bad news about the planet, fam. Which do you want first?
Good news.
All right, I'll give you the good news. I knew you'd say that. You like to eat your desserts first, too.
Wow.
I see.
Wow.
I do, too. I'm not knocking you for that. All right, good news. Good news first. Good news is the Paris Climate Agreement formally takes effect today, with the requisite number of countries ratifying the pact, including the world's biggest polluters, China and the U.S., the agreement is now on. The purpose of it, of course, is to prevent the worst effects of climate change by thwarting a 2-degree Celsius increase in global temperatures by the end of the century. 2 degrees is considered the red line, according to climate scientists, the point of no return for global warming, the point at which we are going to be dealing with huge storms, massive flooding, agricultural devastation, social chaos, pretty much the most serious problems that have ever confronted humanity if we cross that threshold.
Yeah, if you think 2016 has been a bad year, guess what?
Just wait until you get to 2116, folks. If that, it's that red line that has brought the world together. It's that red line that brought more than 190 nations together to approve the Paris Climate Agreement last December to join in this effort to prevent a 2-degree Celsius temperature increase. So we are now living in a Paris Climate Agreement world. It has taken effect. That's the good news. You are ready for the bad news, Sam?
I'm as ready as I'll ever be.
Well, the bad news is the Paris Climate Agreement will not prevent a 2-degree temperature increase by the end of the century.
That's the number that you were just saying is like, hey,
yeah, that's
this
like,
is like the most.
Yeah, that's the red
most,
line. Yeah.
Yeah.
So the one thing.
Sorry.
The one thing that the agreement was supposed to do, it's not going to achieve that. Those are the conclusions of a report released this week by the United Nations. The report stated that world leaders would need to further reduce emissions by 25% on top of their existing Paris Climate Agreement pledges. If they don't, the UN warned, then the planet would likely see temperature rise far higher than the 2 degrees Celsius mark that, as I've tried to warn you, we can't cross. In its current form, in the Paris Climate Agreement's current form, if all countries abide by their pledges, which I should add is a very, very favorable assumption since none of these pledges are legally binding, and we've already talked about how even the U.S. plan to fulfill its commitments to carbon reduction, something known as the Clean Power Plan, is under assault in the courts right here in Washington, D.C., a lawsuit was brought against the Clean Power Plan by 24 attorneys generals of Republican states. Also signing onto that lawsuit was fossil fuel industry. So the U.S. might not even be able to live up to its obligations under this pact if the Clean Power Plan is defeated. But let's assume that the Clean Power Plan survives and that all countries that have signed on to the agreement fulfill their commitments. The UN estimated that the world would still be on track for about a 3 degree temperature increase. They gave the range about a 2.9 to 3.4 degree temperature increase this century. So we're blowing past the red line. Not just, you know, edging across it. We're going past it by about 50%, maybe more. The report adds that, quote, emissions will be 12 to 14 gigatons above levels needed to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. A gigaton seems like a lot to me. Gigaton's a lot, right, Sam?
Yeah. Yeah, that's it's one ton, but it's giga.
Yeah. The problem is the fossil fuel industry sees that there are trillions, another big number, trillions of dollars worth of coal and oil and natural gas and all that other crap that's still in the ground, and they're damn well going to pull it out if they're going to make trillions of dollars off of it. So I peg our chances at avoiding global catastrophe at, like, I don't know, 17%? 17%? What do you think?
So, you know, it's been a hectic year. People are saying things are getting a little hectic. So if there's World War III, like people have been saying, there might be. You know, just casually throwing out the World War III reference there.
Yeah.
And that, if we're to assume that World War III is less bad than, like, the apocalyptic impact of global warming.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe with, like, all the death, in the long run, that would reduce emissions.
Maybe if we just destroy all the factories in a war, sure. All the energy plants.
Wow, that was an awful suggestion by
maybe,
me.
Maybe not a war. Maybe we missed our best chance at preventing catastrophic global warming when Y2K was a dud, when it didn't do anything.
Yeah.
Y2K could have knocked us into the Stone Age and saved the planet. Instead, we just broke right on through to the other side. More unanimous dissent coming up. And welcome back to Unanimous Dissent. The two Sams still here with you, still broadcasting from Washington, D.C.
So we've taken some time this week to talk to people outside of the Beltway about the election, people in swing states. We had Paul Blessed on Wednesday to talk North Carolina. We had Matt Chrisman on Thursday to talk about Ohio, both residents of those states. Today, we'll be having a guest call in from Wisconsin to talk about the crucial Senate race going on there. But for some background, Senator Ron Johnson is in many ways the typical Republican lawmaker right now. He unseated Democrat Russ Feingold in 2010 in the AstroTurf Tea Party wave. Now Johnson backs Donald Trump and appears to have no qualms with that whatsoever, so much for the small government revolution. But Feingold is back from the political dead, well, political coma, I guess, and has been really giving it to Johnson this time around in a bid to return the favor, or he was until recently. Throughout most of the general, polls showed Feingold with a healthy lead over Johnson. The running Huffington Post aggregate showed the Democrat up by 8 in the middle of the summer, but its latest numbers now show Feingold with just a 4-point spread. More worryingly for Feingold and Democrats, recent polls put out by Marquette University Law School show that the race is getting closer, with Feingold only up by 1. How could this happen? One answer, perhaps, is the tons of dark money that has gone in to support Johnson. The Wisconsin State Journal reported 2 weeks ago that super PAC money in the race disproportionately favors the Republican, and that the cash is going to fund airtime for anti-Feingold ads. The paper noted that, quote, and that an analysis by the Nonpartisan Center for Responsive Politics found Johnson overwhelmingly benefiting from outside spending in the race by a margin of more than 5-1. Joining us now to talk more about this money and the race more generally is Ruth Conniff, the editor-in-chief of the Madison, Wisconsin-based Progressive Magazine. Welcome, Ruth, and thank you for joining us.
Sure, glad to be here.
So as a Wisconsinite, I was hoping you could talk first and foremost about what voters are seeing there as a result of this money going into a tax on Feingold. You know, what kind of ads are you seeing and what kind of message do they have?
Ron Johnson has a couple of pretty powerful attack ads against Russ Feingold. One of them is sort of a swift boat attack. Because Feingold is one of the authors of the McCain-Feingold campaign finance reform and is a, you know, was the poorest man in the U.S. Senate and a longtime advocate for getting money out of politics, it's, I think, a strategy of the Johnson campaign to talk about him as a hypocrite who's accepted outside money in this race. And in fact, in the wake of Citizens United, he has accepted outside money. A lot of outside money has poured into the state of Wisconsin, some of it not under Feingold's control. So there's a pretty powerful attack ad on the radio and on television in which Johnson plays tape of Feingold in 2010 and then this year talking about the money that's come into the race and pledging that he's not going to take outside money. And then, of course, now there are 527 groups that were set up in the wake of Citizens United, which is the decision that Feingold attacked. And those groups are, in fact, pouring money into Wisconsin. So that's one ad that's been pretty powerful. Another ad is an abortion-related ad. You know, Feingold is pro-choice, and he's got support from Planned Parenthood. And there is, in Wisconsin, a large anti-abortion constituency. Many of them not Trump supporters, actually. Ted Cruz won the state by 13 points in the Republican primary, but many of them, that's a very big issue for them. And so even though Hillary Clinton is up by 6 points in the latest polls in Wisconsin, Feingold's 1% might be in part due to this ad that's been all over the state talking a lot about so-called partial birth abortion, late-term abortion, and tying Feingold to, you know, to the sort of gory description of that procedure.
You said that a lot of outside money has been flowing in for Ron Johnson. Where's a lot of that money? I know I read somewhere that a PAC affiliated with Mitch McConnell has dumped a lot of money there recently. What other groups are funneling money into that race?
The biggest groups that are supporting Johnson, and he is up by 5.7-1 in terms of outside money.
Wow.
Coming in. So he's 5-7-1 outspending Feingold. Pro-Johnson groups are outspending pro-Feingold groups. Freedom Partners, which is a Koch brothers group, is the biggest spender. Reform America PAC is another one. Club for Growth and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Those are the top groups that are pouring money into Wisconsin. And, you know, of course, the Koch brothers, who are not fans of Donald Trump, have pledged to put a lot of money in down ballot. And there's going to be even more money coming in. Americans for Prosperity, also funded by the Koch brothers, just announced another $950,000 ad buy. National Republican Senatorial Committee just announced another $1 million buy. So there's going to be a lot more money coming in at the very end of this race, pouring into Ron Johnson. Another, you know, the Republicans are trying to hang on to the Senate. And that's, you know, that's been a priority this year for a lot of those groups.
You know, it's interesting that apparently with these two ads that you described earlier, that abortion apparently might be sort of making headway as an issue in Wisconsin. It seems to portend that Supreme Court obstructionism might actually help Republicans this time around. Are we seeing much about the Supreme Court in the race?
Well, Feingold points out that Johnson's been instrumental in blocking justice on the Supreme Court, and that's been, you know, a cause of his. I mean, among other things, you know, he's very much against allowing President Obama to make an appointment to the U.S. Supreme Court, and as you pointed out at the beginning, a supporter of Donald Trump, and you know, he's an obstructionist and committed to the Mitch McConnell program in Washington.
We talked about how Feingold was up, you know, double digits over the summer. And then that was during when there was a primary going on as far as the presidential election. Since then, we've seen both the nominees, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, competing against each other in the general election. And during that time, that's when Feingold's lead has appeared to shrink. Now, that could be a result of what we've already talked about, the effective ads. You've mentioned the outside money flowing into the election. I'm wondering how the dynamic of the presidential race, though, might be weighing on this as well. Has Hillary Clinton as the Democratic nominee harmed Feingold's chances? Could that be a reason for why he's going down in the polls?
I don't think that Hillary Clinton has done any damage to Russ Feingold. It's possible that Wisconsin, like other states, is going to be a place where Democrats are worried about getting young voters, the people who came out for Obama in 2008, the very significant Bernie Sanders constituency. Bernie Sanders won the Democratic primary in Wisconsin. So that, you know, those are likely Feingold voters, because Feingold is not so much associated with the institutional Democratic Party as he is, you know, he was a lone vote against the U.S. Patriot Act. He's taken this principled progressive stand on a lot of issues not tied to banks. You know, so Bernie Sanders voters will vote for Russ Feingold. I think, however, presidential year is a good year for Feingold to be up in Wisconsin, because Wisconsin goes blue in presidential years, even though our governor and both chambers of our legislature are Republican. So in non-presidential years, Republicans have gained an enormous amount of power here. We've been redistricted, so Congress, you know, the House of Representatives doesn't look good. But in a Senate race in a presidential year is the time to run as a Democrat in Wisconsin. And so I think basically Feingold will benefit from Hillary Clinton being, you know, running for president this year. And I think partly because the Clinton folks will spend a lot of money, and Feingold doesn't spend a lot of money. And so in previous years when he ran and won, he was helped in part by his fellow Democrats who, you know, made it more of a race about Democrat versus Republican. And he was able to, you know, capture some of those votes.
Do you think the, polls are showing Clinton with about a 6-point lead in Wisconsin right now? Do you think that's about accurate with where the voters are? Are you surprised that that number isn't higher or closer?
I think that seems right to me. You know, I think that this is not likely to be the year that Wisconsin goes red in the presidential year, because, as I pointed out earlier, the Republicans in our state are not pro-Trump. Some of the really popular and powerful right-wing talk radio figures like Charlie Sykes are anti-Trump, sort of the never-Trump constituency here. And those, you know, northern Wisconsin Catholic pro-life voters are not fans of, you know, sort of the tawdry reality TV show that is the, you know, the Trump campaign and his, you know, how he comes across. He's not a Christian conservative favorite for, you know, for upstate Catholics in Wisconsin. So I think for that reason, I would be surprised if Trump won Wisconsin. I think Hillary will win. I think 6 points sounds right. And I think, you know, Sanders won by 13 points, though, here. So the real question here, as in other places, is whether young voters, people of color, you know, come out, people who haven't voted before, who are energized by the Sanders campaign, come out and vote against Donald Trump and for Hillary.
So I believe I've seen some headlines about Sanders campaigning for Feingold. You've already sort of talked about this a little bit with the possibility of the Clintons, you know, turning their machine a little to Wisconsin in the waning days to help. But do you think that Democrats on the national stage could be doing a little more to help Feingold right now? Are they sort of making the right move here by not going into panic mode?
Well, Tim Kaine was here and Feingold wasn't at that event, so that didn't seem great from a strategic point of view. Bernie Sanders came and appeared with Feingold a couple of weeks ago in Madison. So I think that, you know, that makes sense. And it makes sense that they, as Senate colleagues with similar politics, would appear together. You know, I mean, Feingold has a very local problem here, statewide problem, which is that he was, it was very, very sad for progressives when he lost in 2010. He's seen not only as, you know, a progressive senator from Wisconsin, but really as a leader of progressive movement in a lot of ways, you know, not just against Republicans, but against sort of the corporate establishment wing of the Democratic Party, being a strong advocate for campaign finance reform, being a strong advocate for civil liberties, for privacy, against the Patriot Act, a sort of a principled maverick progressive politician. But we went through the Scott Walker attack on collective bargaining here, the massive historic protests around the Capitol in Madison, and Feingold wasn't here then. He was traveling, he was teaching law, he was at Oxford for a while, and there were T-shirts that were printed up all over Wisconsin with his picture saying, this is what a governor looks like. And people really saw him as somebody who could save Wisconsin from this right-wing attack. And he wasn't here for that. And so I think that may be part of the problem that he's experiencing now. He also set up an organization that raised money for him and sort of kept things going for a future campaign for him. And Ron Johnson has made a lot of hay out of that. So in a way, you know, I think part of what's happening with his poll numbers has to do with his you know, his base and things having shifted, politics having shifted here, and maybe some disappointment about what happened.
That was going to be my next question. Is it doesn't seem that long ago, but I guess it's been about 5 years since 5 or 6 years since we had those labor battles in Wisconsin, and we had the whole recall campaign that ultimately didn't succeed against Scott Walker. What are the lingering effects of that big fight a few years ago? I guess you talked about how it could be animating the Senate race a little bit, with people a bit disappointed that Feingold wasn't in those fights. But how is it still animating the presidential race, and how is it animating the relationship between Governor Scott Walker and the electorate there still?
Well, Scott Walker is extremely unpopular.
That's a relief.
There's been a very, brutal shift in quality of life for a lot of people in Wisconsin. We're enduring austerity. There have been, mass exodus of public employees and teachers from the teaching profession, people who are really directly affected by the policies that ended collective bargaining for them and also hurt their wages and their retirement benefits and their health care. And even more than that, I think, Walker created or nurtured, I guess didn't create, but nurtured a politics of resentment in Wisconsin that has been really toxic for the state. So if you talk to school teachers in Wisconsin, they feel really like targets of a lot of hostility. And they, saw themselves as people who are trying to do a good job and do something for kids. And now, have been really vilified by the governor. And so in addition to sort of the material deprivations that some people are experiencing, there's just this really divisive feeling. And it's not unlike what's happening nationally with the Trump campaign. It's not that those sentiments weren't there. There wasn't something there to exploit, because obviously there was. But what used to feel like a congenial social environment has turned into this sort of toxic, hostile political environment with these different camps. And like Trump, Walker has focused a lot of anxious working people's hostility downward, or at least sideways at neighbors who, are firefighters, police officers, prison guards, teachers, public employee union members. And so it's really neighbor versus neighbor. And that's really torn things up here. And our economy's not doing well under Walker, so there's even more anxiety and hostility. So it's been, it's been brutal. It's been a brutal few years.
Wisconsin's junior senator, Tammy Baldwin, she's a bit of a known quantity in progressive circles. She obviously made history in 2012 as the first openly gay woman senator, or I believe openly gay senator in U.S. history. I can't remember off the
elected.
Top.
She was the first woman senator from Wisconsin, and she was the first openly gay senator elected.
Right, in the U.S.
Yeah.
Sorry, what sort of role is Baldwin playing as a sort of support character for Feingold during this election?
Feingold, and I've seen her out on the stump a little bit, talking about the need to support Feingold along with Hillary Clinton. And she is, not up this year. She's not running to stay in her own seat. So she's got some time to campaign. And she, continues to be a progressive leader. She's a really strong advocate for fair trade, which is a big deal in Wisconsin and a divisive issue in this election on the Republican side, especially. So she has, she has a very particular brand of progressive Wisconsin politics that's very similar to Russ Feingold. So she's been, putting her shoulder to the wheel. So has Elizabeth Warren. The progressives in the U.S. Senate would like to add somebody to their numbers. And so they have been out campaigning for Russ.
Ruth Conniff, editor-in-chief of the Madison, Wisconsin-based Progressive Magazine. Real quick, Ruth, where can people read that or find it online?
You can find us online at www.progressive.org, and you can subscribe to the magazine right there.
And you can follow Ruth on Twitter at rconniff with two N's and two F's.
Thanks so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Thanks, Ruth.
More Dissent coming up. Unanimous Dissent still here with you, still broadcasting out of the Radio Sputnik studios in Washington, D.C. I'm Sam Sachs.
I'm Sam Knight.
We're the District Sentinel news team, and you can read all of our latest reports over at www.districtsentinel.com. It's Friday. We all know what happens on Friday.
We do.
But first, quick shout out to the Chicago Cubs for winning the World Series, by the way. We haven't had a chance to talk about that on the radio show. That was a hell of a game seven that I'm sure everybody watched. Sam listened to it on the radio.
Yeah, hell yeah.
Which was a good call considering how awful a lot of the announcing is on TV. I know I'm going to be accused of being a bandwagon fan, but I've been a longtime fan of the Cubs.
Oh, my God. This is literally the first I've ever heard of it.
You've seen my Cubs shirts. I grew up. All right. Here's my proof. I grew up in Daytona Beach, which was home to affiliated single A ball club, the Daytona Beach Cubs. I've been to Wrigley. So look, the Daytona Beach Cubs were a great team. I've been to dozens of Daytona Beach Cubs games. That's enough credit for me to claim a Cubs fan now that they've won the World Series.
Kevin Bacon was in a movie with Bill Murray, who's a Cubs fan. I really like Groundhog Day.
All right, whatever. By the way, I found out a few years ago that the Cubs actually shut down their Daytona Cubs franchise. But you can fact check it. It did exist at one point. But that didn't end single A baseball in Daytona Beach. Instead, the Cincinnati Reds have moved in with a single A squad known as the Daytona Tortugas.
Hmm. Oh, that's a pretty cool name, actually.
Yes. I have yet to attend a Tortugas game, but it's near the top of my list of things to do. Anyway, congrats to the Cubs. Congrats to the fans, good culture that will assuredly be ruined now that they've won a World Series. Enough of that. Let's turn now to the business at hand. Let's bring in the garbage can. Phew. There it is.
Oh, man. Oh, God, it's got a whole election cycle worth of people in there and bad takes.
The flies have become overwhelming. The flies are bad.
I thought we said we were going to, like, try to kill a few of them or, like, trap them and let them outside or something.
Should we clean the garbage can out a little bit after the election, get it fresh for some new candidates afterward, or should we just keep it getting dirtier and dirtier?
Let's put off that decision till next week, but I'm leaning towards just keep it dirty.
Okay, I'm down with that. Okay, folks, without further ado, your garbage candidates of the week.
Garbage candidate number one, the Washington Post. Nerves are almost certainly frayed at the flagship publication in the nation's capital, as they are everywhere in D.C., including here at Times. 2016, am I right?
Yep.
But that is no excuse for reporting done by the Washington Post in the wake of Halloween on Monday.
I can tell you're really upset about this.
There's a report based on a bunch of whiny neighborhood listserv dads. Quote, local greedy Halloween kids empty an unattended candy bowl and divide a D.C. neighborhood, trumpets the paper's headlines.
Is this sure this isn't from The Onion?
No, it's not. This was based on a surveillance video posted by parents from a listserv in one of the most affluent parts of Washington. And the story tells of two kids who took all the candy from a bowl left by one of the parents who wasn't home to hand out candy to trick-or-treaters. Reading now from the article, the children appear to be elementary or middle school students. That's all you need to know, okay? This isn't news. Kids plundering Take One bowls. This is something that happens every year all throughout this country. Probably other countries where they do trick-or-treating. I don't know, Canada, wherever else it may or may not happen. Anywhere they leave candy out for kids, kids take candy.
Yeah.
It's what they do.
Yeah.
Including in Northwest Washington. And as a child of Northwest Washington, I can confirm this tradition holds true in even one of the most affluent areas and most powerful areas of the country. Nonetheless, the Post editorial team thought this should make the cut, giving a platform to such downtrodden people like this woman from Chevy Chase, Maryland, arguably one of the most elite and elitist places in the entire country. I truly hope someone recognizes those children, she wrote. The size of their, quote, candies in scare quotes, the size of their candy bags alone speaks to their intentions. I can't speak to the Post's intention for making this crap news, but whatever the motivation, we are motivated ourselves to nominate the Washington Post for the garbage can.
Yeah. Can I just add, isn't taking all the candy in the bowl considered perhaps a trick?
Yeah. Could be.
So doesn't that fall within the guidelines of trick or treat? I could take one treat, or yes. I could play a trick and take all the treats.
I mean, that's the inherent quote unquote problem with Halloween, is that it's a prankster's holiday.
Yeah.
And if all that happens to you, I don't mean to, you know, quote unquote victim blame here, although I hardly consider these people who had their candy jacked a victim, but you know, I'm not trying to victim blame here, but usually tricks on Halloween involve much worse, like, you know, tricks that might make the news, like, for example, huge acts of vandalism.
Yeah.
Not taking candy from a bowl.
And everybody knows when you put out the take one bowl, somebody's going to take more than one, if not the whole bowl. It's just something, it's just the risk you take by wanting to participate in Halloween, but not really be at your house.
And if I may, like, what's up with the national paper, like, talking about surveillance video that involves kids and like putting these kids on blast? That's like,
yeah,
pretty, it's pretty gross.
All right, moving on.
Anyway, garbage candidate number two, Howard Dean.
Hell yeah. Yeah.
Nice. The former Vermont governor, like many liberals, reacted poorly to FBI Director James Comey's announcement that emails pertinent to the investigation of Hillary Clinton's private server have caused the Bureau to revisit the matter, of course, that happened late last week. Ironically, Comey put himself on the same side as Putin, Dean tweeted on Saturday morning. The governor then qualified this, saying, quote, Comey tried to do what he thought was right. He totally botched the presentation and may have destroyed the credibility of the FBI forever. I think that ship sailed, Governor, but we'll get back to that shortly. Unfortunately, though, on the other note, on the whole Comey same side as Putin thing, the New York Times came out a few days later with a story debunking the theory that the FBI is concealing shady Trump ties to Russia. But it's not a surprise to see a hardline Clinton supporter react to a news about her ethics problems by claiming it's all part of a Russian conspiracy. Not trying to discount all theories about Russian hacking with regards to the DNC and the election, but it's pretty damn silly to see liberals like Dean run with conspiracies about Trump being a literal Kremlin plant. Seems like this comes from a desire to just wish away all the bad and ugly things about America, but guess what? They are right at home in the USA, with ugly nativism and outright bigotry woven deeply into this country's fabric since 1770 dickety six. But for furthering the narrative that Trump is the genesis of some dark Russian plot, and for upchalking flimsy claims with geopolitical implications reminiscent of George W. Bush, the guy Dean was supposed to be the antithesis to in 2004, we are nominating the former governor to the garbage can.
Yeah!
Which brings me to garbage candidate number three, the Federal Bureau of Investigations.
Sensing a bit of a pattern here.
One of the reasons why Clintonite critiques of Comey and the FBI are so frustrating, thinking of Howard Dean when he said that the FBI damaged its credibility forever, it has no credibility, and it hasn't for years. Let's be clear. We're talking about the same James Comey who wanted to use a magistrate judge in the last 12 months in order to put a big old asterisk on the Fourth Amendment.
Yep.
If accepted by the courts, it would have allowed judges to order companies to decrypt information protected by their software, which is something that Congress has never given judges the power to do. Congress, of course, consisting of legislators who are also known as lawmakers, people who are supposed to make laws, not FBI directors. Anyway, we're also talking about the same James Comey who believes in the Ferguson effect, this idea that crime is on the rise because cops are scared now of enforcing the law or something, because clearly, you know, heavy-handed law enforcement has led to a lot of punishment. It hasn't. So I don't know. This theory is silly. And of course, this is the same FBI seems to have largely occupied itself since the war on terror began with finding feeble, vulnerable Muslims to entrap them in headline-grabbing, quote-unquote, terrorist plots. So it's not at all surprising that people would think the average Fed is rabidly pro-Trump. You don't need to bleat the Kremlin plot talking points to surmise that. The New York Times noted that, quote, fairly or not, Comey's recent actions evoke memories of J. Edgar Hoover, the authoritarian who ran the FBI for almost 50 years, using his power to attack dissidents and his political opponents. Hoover was the last FBI to be accused, at least by some historians, of trying to influence a presidential election, the Times noted, by feeding useful scraps of information on Harry S. Truman, a Democrat, to the campaign of Thomas E. Dewey, a Republican. Didn't work out for Dewey that well. That's another story. The Times also noted, by the way, that the FBI once tried to blackmail Martin Luther King Jr. into suicide. Oops. Just one of the many awful things the Bureau did under Hoover, effectively running a secret police force in the good old USA. But while liberals might not be willing to throw this Cold War relic into history's trash heap, something that would greatly help this country's efforts to reform its law enforcement, we here at Unanimous Dissent will nominate the FBI to history's trash heap this week, at least, with the garbage can.
Yes, we will, very happily. Garbage candidate number four, Chris Saliza. This, too, is related to the FBI.
Hell yeah.
Ever since Comey stepped in it, there's been this really stupid trend, which Sam touched on a bit, for people to think that the FBI used to be this really awesome, noble institution, as though J. Edgar Hoover never existed. Anyways, this strand of thinking was best personified by Chris Saliza and his The Fix column over at the Washington Post.
More like The Broke.
Yeah, more like The Broke. And Washington Post, also a nominee today.
Yeah.
Saliza writes, quote, the FBI has long been an iconic institution in American life. He then adds this inexplicable line, quote, from Elliot Ness to Clarice Starling, the image of the FBI, unflappable, smart, and relentlessly fair, has been sterling. After the last week's announcement by FBI Director James Comey that the investigation into Hillary Clinton's private email server continues, it's hard to see it staying that way. So, a few things. One, Elliot Ness was not in the FBI. He was one of the untouchables enforcing prohibition. Clarice Starling is also not in the FBI. At least she's not a real FBI agent. She's a fictional character played by Jodie Foster in the movie Silence of the Lambs. Hello, Clarice.
She was badass in that, though.
She was. So, okay, we're not off to the best start here already, Chris. Second, this idea that the FBI is this unflappable, smart, and relentlessly fair institution. For all the reasons Sam has already mentioned, are you being serious? COINTELPRO, I mean,
MLK, Fred Hampton.
Stuff that's just happened in the last 12 months with regards to Apple and things like that. It's pretty clear. Now, Chris was ridiculed online for this, as you'd expect, promptly deleted the entire paragraph that I just read from his article. If you check over at the Washington Post, it simply states the article has been updated. Doesn't say how or where, but we all know.
Yeah.
Maybe that last minute edit will save Mr. Saliza from the garbage can, but it didn't save him from nomination. That's for sure.
I think the edit, by the way, makes it worse. But
it could.
We'll get
it
back to that.
Definitely could make
we'll
it worse. All right. Garbage candidate number five, NASCAR driver Reed Sorensen. Oh, yeah. This Daytona boy has a few things to say about NASCAR. So this coming weekend at the AAA Texas 500, a NASCAR race at the Texas Motor Speedway in Fort Worth, one car will be making a political statement. Driver Reed Sorensen's premium motorsports Toyota will be donning decals promoting the campaign of one Donald J. Trump. The white number 55 car will have red, white, and blue designs promoting Trump and campaign running mate Mike Pence. The vehicle will also don Trump's Make America Great Again campaign slogan. This is pretty gross. But it actually fits right in with NASCAR culture. As The Hill notes, NASCAR CEO Brian France and several former and current NASCAR drivers backed Trump in early February during the GOP's presidential primaries. Mr. Trump is changing American politics forever, and his leadership and strength are desperately needed, France said back in February. He added that Trump has had an incredible career and achieved tremendous success. This is what we need for our country. Retired racer Bill Elliott has also spoken highly of Trump, calling Trump a leader representing strength and common sense solutions. So actually, we might have to throw a few NASCAR folks in the garbage can this week. Might not just be Reed Sorensen.
Yeah.
Either way, though, Reed Sorensen and his number 55 car are nominated for the garbage can. And, you know, I wish him the best. I hope he doesn't get injured in this upcoming event. But I wouldn't mind seeing that damn Trump car get spun out into the wall and not able to finish, if you know what I mean.
I think it's more likely with that Trump logo, the blood will rush to his head and he might pull a Tony Stewart and kill a guy.
He just wanted to get a dig in on Tony Stewart there. All right, garbage candidate number six, the Georgetown Business Improvement District. We're going local with this one.
Oh, yeah.
Everybody who lives in Washington, D.C. knows, and a lot of people who visit will realize, that our metro system sucks. It's in shambles. It's a disaster. It's unreliable. It can be deadly. There's a new budget that's been proposed that calls for further slashes in service along with fare increases. The metro situation has become dangerous.
And unacceptable. Unironically.
Unironically. Well, people not at all affected by the crummy metro are those who live on the posh side of town in Georgetown, world-renowned for its swankiness. Rich people live there, and they don't really rely on public transportation. There's no metro stop in Georgetown.
They fought it for years, yes, to try to keep out the riffraff,
yes,
which has
certainly
very heavy racist connotations.
Yes, but the Georgetown Business Improvement District did unveil new plans for its own mass transportation system. Get this, it's a gondola system. Yes, a gondola system that will connect Georgetown across the river to Arlington, Virginia. A study released Thursday by the Georgetown Business Improvement District estimated the cost of this ridiculous gondola system would be between $80 and $90 million. Joe Sternlieb, the president of the Improvement District, told the ABC News that the aerial gondola project isn't some fanciful futuristic idea or a tourist gimmick. He said that it's an option for commuters that's cool and feasible. I can promise you right now that it's neither. Anyway, I'm just saying now's not the best time to be proposing gondola rides for rich people in Georgetown,
yeah,
especially when working people all over the rest of the city are forced to rely on a crumbling metro system. Okay, look, those are our candidates. We have a couple other ones. Listeners to the show suggested some other people to be tossed into the can. Franklin Foer was nominated. He wrote that article alleging there was a secret link between Trump and a Russian bank, which was promptly debunked by, well, everyone. We also heard from Twitter user at IncredibleAss again, who nominated Lena Dunham for her pantsuit rap and hero worshiping of Hillary Clinton. I saw the pantsuit rap, folks. I can confirm it was bad, not worth watching, definitely garbage can material. All right, that's all I got. Who's going in? Who should go in the garbage can?
It's got to be the FBI. We've set it up as a proxy for scrapping the FBI.
Yeah.
Let's throw the FBI in the damn garbage can.
Plus, I defended Comey a little bit earlier this week.
You know,
I felt weird about it.
We got to balance it. You know,
he's
got he's been taking some unfair criticism, but
all right, here we go.
He should be in the trash.
The FBI, FBI, you are going in the garbage can.
Oh, there it goes.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, no. I think I see some of J. Edgar Hoover's undergarments.
Turn over your gun and badge. You're going in the can.
Yeah.
That'll do it for Unanimous Dissent today.
Wait. You have the right to remain in the can.
You can listen to this show and all of our shows by going to the Radio Sputnik website or by checking out our website at www.districtsentinel.com. Subscribe to the show on iTunes by searching for District Sentinel Radio. Stick around for next week's shows. We're not going anywhere. We'll stay here in D.C. so you don't have to be.